extended family. Golden was shocked to learn that her husband expected her to live the life of a traditional Nigerian woman. That meant no birth control, no work outside the home, and in short, no equality with her husband. Unable to accept these conditions, she left Nigeria with their son, and she divorced her husband. Marita Golden's first novel has just been published. It's called A Woman's Place, and it follows the lives of three black women who meet in the late 60s when they're students at a predominantly white college. They're each changed in unexpected ways by the experience. One woman, Faith, becomes a Muslim and marries and devotes herself to her husband and children. Crystal becomes a poet and marries a white filmmaker. And Serena goes to Africa to devote herself to her political and social ideals. Each of these lives are given equal weight in Golden's novel, and none of the lives are romanticized. Marita Golden has her BA from American University and her MS from Columbia University. She lives in Washington, D.C. with her son, Tunde. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
My pleasure to be here again.
Before we talk about some of the ideas in your book, I'd love it if you'd open with a reading from your novel. And why don't you read the opening from it?
Okay. The novel is written in the first person, so that this first part deals with one of the major characters, Faith. Winthrop University. Mama said she liked the sound of the name. Said it made her think of fine china, tweed suits, and money in the bank. But I just looked at the pictures in the catalog they sent and wondered why I was supposed to want everything I saw. Because that's how Mama made it sound. Like coming here wasn't my first chance, but my last one, too. But nothing seems real. Not the teachers, not the students, and sometimes even me. If there was something here for me to believe in, I wouldn't be flunking out. I remember the first time I went into Hawthorne Hall to take Western Civilization I. I caught my breath when I walked in through the door, and all these different smells and sensations hit me all at once. The ceiling was real high, and there was a chandelier hanging over a white marble sculpture of some nymphs. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and even though there was sunshine coming through the windows, there seemed to be more shadows than light. All along the walls were portraits of these old men, wearing fancy clothes, whiskers, and the expressions I've seen on a lot of pictures of real rich people, like they were surprised by how much they had, and surprised, too, that they didn't have even more. Those are the men who founded the school, and I could tell they liked what they saw when they looked at what they left behind. I walked down the long marble hallway, past the high-backed leather chairs and the mahogany tables, and there were more nymphs in every corner. Everything I saw made me feel small. Looked like nothing had ever been touched. Looked like that stuff wasn't even made to be touched. Reminded me how my mama used to warn me not to put my hands on anything in the homes of those people she cleaned house for. I always wondered what my hands would do to those mirrors and dishes. Their hands wouldn't. And as I got closer to my classroom, I wondered what I could learn in a building like that that was going to save me, because that's what my mama told me education was supposed to do. Anyway, the feeling I got walking through that building, down those halls, sank into my skin and made me sick. I think I felt that way because I couldn't find anything there that made me think of me. By the time I got to the classroom, my hands were all sweaty and the muscles in my stomach were in knots so tight, I almost had cramps. I looked in and saw over 100 students, saw an empty seat for me, and not another black face. Then, without even thinking about it, just feeling like this was what I had to do, I turned around and walked back to the entrance. On the way out of the building, those old men in whiskers looked down at me again. I knew they didn't see me, and I knew I didn't care.
It's Marita Golden reading an excerpt of her new novel, A Woman's Place. Did you have similar feelings like that at all? Were there expectations of how college was going to be a savior in a way? And did you feel alienation at all similar to the character in your novel?
No, my experience was really exactly the opposite. But I went to a white undergraduate school, a white graduate school, and after teaching in Nigeria and then at a black junior college in Boston, I taught at Emerson College in Boston for 2.5 years. And I had the experience of looking at education from the other side of the classroom as someone who was giving it, supposedly, theoretically anyway, rather than receiving it. And I saw that for many black students, a white campus, a white college campus, is not necessarily the best place for them to receive an education. I think that the process of education really is about finding something in the institution that you're attending that you can believe in. I was lucky in that I went to American University in Washington, and I was fully capable of dealing with the situation there. I was a very, I could deal with systems. I could deal with the system, which is what getting an education is really about. But for a lot of black students, and Faith happens to be one of these in the novel, a more nurturing, a more intimate environment that more closely reflects the culture and expectations and psychology that they come from is needed to successfully manipulate the system. So that I wanted to write about a student who was very different than myself, and write about how, for some black students, no, the white institution is not necessarily the best place.
The father of one of the characters says at one point that the black colleges are nice, they serve their purpose, but you get too comfortable, you feel too safe.
Yeah.
Have you heard that expressed a lot?
Yeah, I've heard that expressed, that they're a womb. But I don't know that there's necessarily anything wrong with that. I think that for some students, I think a lot depends on the personality of the student. One of the big problems that black students do have, though, is manipulating systems. For example, too often black students are overwhelmed by the largeness of white institutions. They have not been informed by counselors and by parents the importance of, for example, getting papers back to such and such an office on time. Often black students don't realize the importance of personal relationships with a teacher, how important it is to let the teacher know your name, go back to the office. I had to literally beg my black students to take advantage of me as a resource. And a lot of it is just that they don't realize that getting an education is a multifaceted operation. It's not just attending classes. And very often white students have seen their parents bring the boss their home to dinner so that they know the advantages and the necessity for a certain level of politicking and social relations, whereas black students haven't seen that. So that I wanted to write about some of those things in the book.
One of the students in your novel who negotiates this predominantly white college better than the student whose excerpt you just read becomes more involved in politics. And a friend of hers who isn't a student says that students really don't understand revolutionary politics. It's the people on the street mm-hmm. who really understand mm-hmm. it. And you see this big schism between, mm-hmm. Quote, street people and mm-hmm. students. Mm-hmm. Have you observed that a lot and that there's a division?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we worried a lot about in the 60s was being educated away from, quote, our blackness, and being so educated that we would become irrelevant to the needs of the black community. And this character says to Serena, you think that a bunch of bourgeoisie college students are going to start a revolution, and it's not going to happen that way. It's going to come, like all revolutions, from people who aren't necessarily in college and who aren't privileged. So that was a real concern. That was a real big concern for many of us who were politically aware and active. And how we've managed to deal with that in the 80s is that in our careers, and I wrote a piece for Essence last year on this same topic, in our careers, if we're in a white institution or wherever we are, we try to use whatever power or influence we have, many of us, to try to affect whatever change we can. For example, when I was teaching at Emerson College, I sort of saw myself as an intellectual agent provocateur. That is, I was very aware that as a black female standing in front of the class, on the one hand, I had less credibility with all the students than a white male would have. But by virtue of the fact that I lived overseas, that I was that I had manipulated the white system successfully, that I had a certain set of political beliefs that they needed to be exposed to, that I was also in a very powerful position to influence their little minds. So I used the classroom to get across a lot of political messages and to raise their level of consciousness. I was ostensibly teaching journalism, but we touched on everything, racism, prejudice, the whole bag of beans. And so that I found another colleague of mine who went to Columbia Journalism School with me. She ended up writing editorials for the Boston Globe. And she began writing editorials about issues affecting really poor people in Boston. If she hadn't been on the editorial board, those issues would not have been addressed. So that in the 60s, I think we really felt that we had to be on the front lines with guns in our hands. We grew up to find that we could work in the system and still affect some modicum of positive change, I think.
My guest is writer Marita Golden. Her new novel is titled A Woman's Place. You know, you mentioned this fear of being educated away from other black people and educated away from blackness. Well, the three students in this end up being really removed from their families, from their parents. Mm-hmm. And they're changed in ways by the university experience that really separates them from the lives that they used to have. Do you see that as being a kind of inevitable result of either college education or a college education for a black student on a predominantly white campus?
Well, I think it's something that any student who doesn't have the university experience as something that's a generational experience will go through. Immigrant kids go through it. Irish kids, Armenian kids go through it. And there is that same tension for black students. I know I was the first person in my family to complete a college education. For most of my contemporaries that I was really friendly with in college, that was a situation. Some of our parents later did go to college because, you know, later on it became the end thing for older people to go back. But we were the groundbreakers, and there is to some extent that tension there, and you just try to negotiate it. But I also think that this fear of being educated away from a sense of your identity is overemphasized, and I think it's overemphasized by black people because to some extent, we have bought into the stereotype that whites have that the only way you're black is if you're poor. The only way you can be black is if you're uneducated. And we really, to some extent, have bought that belief, and it's ingrained in us so deeply that we aren't aware of how dangerous it is. So because I know just so many black people who come from humble backgrounds. If you sit down and talk to them today, you'd think that, you know, boy, you know, this is a person who's been middle class for generations. And then when they tell you their background, you're astounded. But they're very comfortable with where they came from and where they are. And it's a continual process of evolution. So that what we're finding is that, yes, you can be black and work for the Boston Globe, and that we just have, as a people, some psychological homework to do.
You know, another interesting point, too, is that I think a lot of revolutionaries have been from the middle class and have been very educated.
Yeah, Castro is one. That's usually what happens. They usually end up co-opting the situation once the masses provide the steam, so to speak. Yeah.
One of your characters goes off to Africa to work in a way so that she could fulfill her political and social beliefs and do something very meaningful, because she thinks the work that she'd end up doing in America would seem trivial by comparison. And she stays there, and she and I was thinking of her and of you as I was reading the book, because just from the little I know of you from your memoirs, I was seeing bits of you in all of the women.
Sure.
And it struck me that you left Nigeria, and she stayed in Africa. And I thought that the difference was that you went there as a wife, and she went there as
a
single woman.
Exactly. If I'd had my druthers, I would have stayed in Africa, because the experience of living in a black country was a very positive one for me. I did have a career. I was a media consultant, a university professor, because of the education that I brought with me from America. I learned in Africa that if I'd been born there as a female child, that the odds against me doing as well educationally as I did in this country would have been really great. But because I took a lot of training with me, I was doing things over there that I couldn't have done as easily over here. But as you say, because I had a child and because of the complications of the marriage, I did have to come back to the States. I had toyed with the idea a couple of years ago of going back, and one of the places I wanted to go back to was Zimbabwe. And I had tried to get money to do some research on the position of women there. And I didn't have any luck, but I'd done all this research. And so I said, well, I can't go to Zimbabwe, so Serena will go to Zimbabwe. And I was also intrigued with the idea of writing about a woman who wanted to really dedicate her life to political action and in a different context than this one. And also with what she finds out about the women's situation in Africa, it's kind of an echo of the situation that one of the other characters find themselves in. That is, Faith is... That is, they're echoes, you know.
Because Faith finds her world in the family.
It's a kind of psychological bondage. The women in Africa are oppressed economically by poverty and cultural tradition, so that it's an echo of it, too.
This character, Serena, goes to Africa thinking that things will be more obvious in a way, more simple there, that the problems will be more simple to address. And a friend of hers says, you think a complex system of neocolonialism plus tribalism and sexism is easy. Is that what you found to be
true?
Yeah,
that's what I found, that I went to Africa as a romantic and I came back as a realist. That did not mean that I couldn't live in Africa again. But I think that just the process of growing up and coming to terms with what the real world is about, and the fact that political systems do know more really than mirror the limitations of man and woman, that chastens you a bit, you know, that chastens you somewhat.
My guest is Marita Golden, who's just written her first novel. Her new novel is called A Woman's Place. Another character, Faith, changes her name and becomes a Muslim and marries mm-hmm. and devotes all of her energy to home and family. She has, I think, 4 children. Mm-hmm. Now, she is the woman whose passage you read at the beginning. That was from mm-hmm. her point of view. And she's, of the 3 women in your book, the one who is most uncomfortable in the white world and in the university world. And do you think that a lot of women who become Muslims are retreating from a world they feel insecure in and uncomfortable in, and that they find this more circumscribed world where a woman's role is written out very carefully to be mm-hmm. more comfortable?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. One of the reasons that I think, blacks in particular, I think, have been attracted to Islam, Orthodox Islam or Black Islam, either one, for a variety of reasons. One, because I think they found in it a way to reject white society and reject some of the definitions, the negative definitions imposed on them by white society. Also, it was a way to align oneself with a legitimate, world-recognized religion. That nobody, you know, that is, as a Black American, your legitimacy is always questioned. Are you valid? Where do you belong? Where is your home? What do you own? What do you do? That's always a question. But if you become a Muslim, you're automatically a member of a religion that is one of the dominant religions in the world. You're automatically rejecting so much of white society that you may have found oppressive. And I found it very interesting that some of the most dynamic and intelligent young Black women of my generation that I knew have become Muslims. And they would be in the middle of very dynamic careers and doing a lot of things. And then suddenly, next thing I found out, they were married to a Muslim or they were one of 3 wives. And I think that Black women, just as white women, often struggle with the responsibility of identity. That is, often, who are we? And we still tend very often to look to marriage, to look to men. And for Black women, you also have to remember that we often labor under so many fears, psychosexual fears around the whole man-woman relationship thing. We're told that if we get too much education, we won't get a man. We're told that there aren't any Black men out there. We're told that, well, all you're going to do is marry a white man anyway. And by marrying, by going into that kind of cloistered life, that, as you said, is a very easy, simple answer. And it seems to make everything very clear.
For a while.
For a while. But many of the women that I know have outgrown it. But I do know some women who have stayed in it. Now, in the book, I also, one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to deal with, I didn't want to disparage Islam, because as a person who I consider myself a fairly serious Christian, I respect all religions. And it would have been very easy to just, in the beginning of the book, she's a Muslim, and then she evolves and she divorces her husband, and then she throws off all of her beliefs. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to deal with a woman who was very serious about her faith. See, the problem wasn't that she was a Muslim. The problem was that she was married to a man who didn't want her to grow up. And I think that it's very easy to look at the exterior things and blame it on that. Because I know some progressive Muslims. I know, and that may sound like a contradiction, but I know some couples who are very progressive, and their Muslim faith is not an impediment to their evolution in any way.
Yeah, you mentioned she married someone who didn't want her to grow up, and that's because he's, 20 years?
27 years
her senior.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's his second marriage, and he falls in love with her youth, in a way, and with the possibility of a new life for himself, mm-hmm. which is really something we see happening with a lot of men now. I mean, a lot of men, don't you think, in their late 40s or even early 50s, or remarrying with mm-hmm, younger women mm-hmm, and starting mm-hmm. new families
yeah,
and are
yeah.
recreating a life and trying to avoid what they perceive as the mistakes they made the first time around. But
I think that both of them fell in love, and we all do this, with what they wanted. She wanted a father, and he wanted a new life, and youth promises, as he says, you'll give me babies to ensure that I'll never die, you see. So that I think that we all do that to some extent. We fall in love with the promise that we see in that person's eyes, or what we read into them. And what happens is that one of them has to change in order to make it work.
Have you seen relationships like that work?
Okay, relationships in what sense?
With a 27-year age disparity.
No, I haven't seen many like that at all. But I just knew that Faith was looking for something in her religion, and she was looking for something with this man. So, but I don't know of any particular relationships like that. I would think it would be very difficult.
Your third character is named Crystal. And she, you know, her parents, I think, are hoping that she'll get some, like, great lucrative job, be a real professional, and she becomes a poet, which is not the most high-paying profession around. And she, you know, she's going to live in the world of ideas, basically, and have a lot of artist friends and teach and do workshops when she can. And she marries a white man who they're so afraid that their worst fears will somehow be realized that sometimes they see themselves enacting those fears in spite of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you've witnessed in relationships? That, I mean, do you think it's very difficult to transcend the racial fears or problems that you think you're going to have because of the social system that you live in?
Oh, yeah, sure. You can bring a lot of negativity, certainly to yourself, through your own fears. And one of the things I did, and I kind of did it intentionally, was that I made her parents, her family's reaction much more severe, her father's reaction to this, than his family's reaction. Whereas in reality, generally, white families tend to be more resistant to this than black families do.
Well, her father says, why did you join what the enemy camp? Is that
yeah.
what he says? Why did you join the opposition?
Choose their side.
Their side, yeah.
And it was a topic that I wanted to explore because, well, one, when you have a people integrating a system, even to the small extent that blacks have now, that's one of the things that's going to happen. People are going to work together. They're going to start going out for drinks. They're going to find out, hey, even though you're black, even though you're white, you're a human being. And they're going to start dating, and they're going to fall in love, and they're going to get married. And this is something that I had seen happening with some of my contemporaries. And I wanted to explore it because it would give me a chance to explore some of my own prejudices and ambiguous feelings about it. And also bring something out of the closet. That is, there hasn't been a lot written about interracial relationships in black fiction from this point of view, that is, black females and white males, it's still taboo.
You think it's still more taboo than the other way around, black male, white female?
Definitely. There's still a double standard that if you're a black woman and you do that, somehow you have sold out to a greater extent than a black man who does it. And there's always the feeling that if you marry a white person or if you love a white person or are involved with a white person in that sense, that your blackness will rub off, you know, on them somehow. And black people often feel that automatically, if you marry a white person, you forfeit your identity, not realizing that there are many blacks who marry black people who hate themselves, who despise themselves. So that it's a topic that has a lot of, you know, people are very sensitive about it. It's still taboo. And I think that's one reason I wanted to deal with it, to bring it a little out of the closet.
My perception, too, is that one of the things that a black person would have to deal with from some of their friends if they married or had a relationship with a white person is the sense of, what's the matter, we're not good enough for you?
Mm-hmm. You know? But you see, that has more to do with the black person that's saying that than either the black person, the white person that are married or dating or whatever. And see, the problem is that everybody in this society, black and white, what we're really afraid of is discovering that we are human beings first. That's terrifying to find out, because once you find that out, you have to let go of all the prejudices and stereotypes that you grew up on.
But it's not just the prejudices and stereotypes, too. It's the sense of heritage and tradition, because those two are kind of... Do you know what I mean? Like the negative side is the stereotypes, mm-hmm, and the positive mm-hmm. side is the tradition. And if you marry outside of that tradition, whether mm-hmm. it's race or religion mm-hmm. Or class even, mm-hmm. then you're breaking the sense of heritage.
Of continuity.
Of continuity, yeah. Okay. And that, you know, the religious practices will be different or, you know, maybe the kid won't be baptized mm-hmm. or, you know, you can live in a different kind of neighborhood mm-hmm. or whatever.
And it's a tribal instinct.
Exactly.
To marry within the tribe. So that it's a, you know, in Africa, I found the same thing. Intertribal marriages were, oh God, very much frowned on. And intertribal could be, if you were from just the next village, I mean, that could cause problems. So that, it's a universal instinct. Yeah.
Everybody who you write about in the book has their chance to tell their own part of the story in first person narrative. So you write first person from the perspective of the white filmmaker mm-hmm. who marries the character mm-hmm. the woman we've been mm-hmm. talking about. What did you do to get inside his brain? Because you're crossing sex and race by getting into his head and writing first person.
Okay, let me just ask you one question. Did it work for you?
Yeah.
Okay. What I did was...
Not that I've ever been a white man. But,
That's good to know. But, okay, that's a very interesting question because one of the things that people often think, this is the thing about being a writer. On the one hand, I don't believe, this is going to be a very long answer, I don't believe that there's anything such as pure imagination. I believe that imagination is shaped by experience. But at the same time, if you are a creative person, you are a human being who hopefully is sensitive. And one of the qualities that writers are supposed to have in abundance is empathy, so that what you empathize with is not so much his white maleness, but his humanness. And you, you know, men, you know, and I mean, and I've had experiences with a cross section of men, and they're all pretty much the same, you know, they think they're all different, but they're all pretty much the same. So, you know, guys, you know, men. And you put yourself, okay, if I'm a human being who happens to be a male, based on what I know about my male friends, and this is a male who is fairly sensitive, what would my reaction be to such and such a thing happening to me? And people who are not writers may find this difficult to understand, but it gets to a point where it's not about him being a white male. It's about him being a character who's in pain or a character who was misunderstood by his parents. And we all know people like that. So it's not really quite as difficult as it may seem. I did some talk to people who were filmmakers. I did do some interviewing for that, and I know people who are filmmakers. But as far as his white maleness, I empathize with his pain, his struggles with his parents, the universal things that we all go through.
I think you also tried to get into his head during one or two instances when he was almost about to strike her because they were having a big fight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What did you do to get up empathy for that?
Well, I had watched my parents battle on occasion. And the emotions that a child feels, whether that child is an 8-year-old little black girl or a 10-year-old little white boy, would have to be the same. Terror, fear, guilt, because you can't stop it. You see? So that this goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago. There are certain emotions that affect us all, that are cross-cultural, that even are cross-sexual. So that I used some of the things that came out of my own childhood and gave them to him to make certain points. But it's funny because I just sort of assumed, yeah, okay. It did sort of strike me, how am I going to write about this white guy now? But once I was into it, it seemed no more improbable than writing about Faith, who becomes Aisha and who is totally different than me.
My guest is Marita Golden, and we last talked on Fresh Air about her memoir, Migrations of the Heart. Her new book is her first novel. It's called A Woman's Place. The three women in your novel seem to have the intensity in the relationship with each other that you'd almost expect from, like, war buddies who had helped each other survive in the trenches. And I was wondering if you thought that the experience that they had coming of age together was so intense and that there was so much at stake for all of them that they did have the intensity of being through something very dangerous, as if it mm-hmm, were a mm-hmm. war, you know, and their lives were at stake, mm-hmm. you know, the future of their lives.
Well, certainly the experience of being black on a large white campus, that did draw us all together because we were not prepared for that. And it really did blow some of our minds, literally and figuratively. But also, I think it's important to realize that friendship in black culture among women is a given. I found it very ironic and a little baffling when in the late 60s and early 70s, when I was sort of watching and sometimes reporting on the feminist movement, that for white middle-class women who were involved in it, the legitimacy and necessity of bonds and alliances with other women came as a surprise. Because for black women, friendship has been a psychological necessity and support system that we've had to develop because we were women whose men could be taken from them at any moment to be lynched outside in our backyard or front yard, who could be castrated economically by a system that might make it better for them to leave us than to be with us, so that when all else failed, we had our sisters, we had the woman next door, we had the girl down the hall, and we have been supportive to each other in a way that you'll find it resonates throughout black literature that's written by women. That theme of female bonding and the closeness of friendship is just something that we grow up seeing and we take it for granted. Because to some extent, white men, you know, we don't count for white men. We don't really count too much for white women. Black men often have an ambiguous attitude toward us. So who do we have? We have ourselves. At one point in the book, when Serena is talking about Faith leaving the college and her feeling like she maybe should have done more to keep her there, she says, well, because if she leaves, she'll take some of me with her because I only see me when I look at Crystal or Faith. Now, of course, that's not literally true, but figuratively it is. So that friendship is that's why I think when I was writing the book, when I told my agent, my agent and my editor a couple of years ago when I first started writing this, what I was going to do, and they said, oh, a black the group. You know, and I said, no way, because I really was trying to explore the emotional geography of these women. Not so much, and then she did this, and then the 20 years in Paris, and then nobody, you know. It was more their psychological development and growth and that was binding them, really.
One thing I have to say about all the characters, all three of the leading women in the book, is that they all have difficult lives. You know, no matter what life they've chosen or what life they've accidentally mm-hmm. ended up with, mm-hmm. there are very difficult things that they have to go through in it. And I thought it was interesting that none of them are really romanticized in any way. None of them are living like the perfect life, the mm-hmm. ideal life. Mm-hmm. They all have difficult
things.
Well,
I don't think any of us are living the perfect life in fiction, unless you're reading, Judith Kranz or somebody. Does it supposed to mirror our lives, but also give us another way, I hope, of looking at it. Yeah. So that while, you know, Crystal chooses to be a writer, which is very satisfying, that puts her at odds with her parents. And the choice to, yes, marry this man of a different race forces her to pay a price that really forces her to grow up. She has to grow up, too. There's a lot of growing up that goes on in this book. She has to sort of forgive her husband for being white, which she thought she had, but she hadn't.
Toward the end, one of the women says, I remember when we were going to change the world. Now we're ready to turn it over to a bunch of kids we don't trust or understand. Was that ever your feelings?
Yeah, I feel a little bit like that now when I look at the generation that's coming up now and the times. But I don't know, they're just a product more of the times rather than their own intention to be materialistic and all of that. The world that they're inheriting is just different. The world we were dealing with, we were stepping out into when we got out of college, was benign by comparison. I mean, there is a sense of that, you know, what are these kids gonna do? You know, what are they gonna do with it? Do they know?
There's something I'd like to ask you to read in the book, and I don't know if you'll be comfortable reading this. I think you will be. But the inscription to your son in the dedication. Would you mind reading that? And my guest is Marita Golden, who's just completed her first novel. It's called A Woman's Place.
Okay, this is actually an excerpt from a poem that I wrote a couple of years ago. And it just says, this book is for Tunde, who I am teaching to always walk the way he does now, as though he carries his destiny with him instead of hoping to meet it along the way. And I used to look at, he was younger than, my son's 8 now, and he was about 5, I guess, when I wrote that poem. And I used to look at him walk, you know, and kids are great because they just have so much confidence. They don't know what's waiting for them yet. And he would just walk around the house, you know, just like, you know, just as I say, just like he was carrying his destiny with him. And I've always tried to reinforce that so that he has it now. I just want him to keep it. That's all.
I think of you having this son from the marriage that you had in Nigeria, which is such a different chapter of your life, mm-hmm. and of your son being this constant link with that part of your life and mm-hmm. constant proof that that part of your life happened, mm-hmm. you know, and how different it would be if you didn't have a son from that marriage, you know?
Well, I would have had some child some way. I think there's a part of me that is a nurturer. There is a part of me that is faith, though not quite as extreme. so that I would have either had some child or adopted some child, or I'm a nurturer. That's why I teach. That's why I enjoy teaching, because I like watching people discover who they are, and that's what raising a child is at its best about, really.
I was thinking that there were parts of you in each of the characters, and that when you were writing the novel, you might have been thinking, what would my life have been if instead of mm-hmm. doing sure. what I did, I decided to just give up the idea of work and raise 4 children, uh-huh. or if I'd stayed in Africa. Mm-hmm. Were you thinking about all the options that you didn't take by choosing the life that you did?
Sure. Like, as I said, like Faith's love of her children, which I think she's a very creative mother, even though she's cloistered in that house and to some extent imprisoned, she's a wonderful mother. She really loves her children. And having had a child of my own and having therefore had to get to know child care providers and nursery school people and people who teach little kids very well, I've come to appreciate how creative a process that is when it's done very well by someone who loves what they're doing. So there was that part of imagining, what if I had more kids or wanted that. And with Serena, there was the wondering if I had stayed in Africa, you know, with the political. She's much more political than I am, though. I wanted to write about a woman who really took it as far as I could imagine it going, you know, in terms of really putting yourself on the line for what you do believe in.
You know, ever since the movie The Color Purple, there's been this big debate about whether some of the literature of black women writers is dumping on black mm-hmm. men. And there was a cover story a few months ago in the New York Times that raised and discussed that question. Do you think this is a real issue? I mean, do you think that this is like a serious issue, or do you think that it's something that's just been overplayed and picked up because mm-hmm. so much attention has been paid to it?
Well, I think that it's an issue that occurs in various forms, has occurred in the past. For example, back in the 20s during the Harlem Renaissance, Zora Neale Hurston, for example, was criticized for writing about poor blacks. Middle-class blacks didn't like to read any books where poor black people who didn't speak proper English were the main characters, so that you had to protect the race. You had to at all costs protect the image of the race. Now we have it sort of rearing its ugly head again with the admonition to women writers not to portray anything negative in the relationships between black men and black women. I think that often it's an issue that I think is an outgrowth of the fact that black people are often, unfortunately, very unsophisticated about the purposes of literature and the insidious nature of the media. We tend to be people who are more addicted to the media than anybody else. I think there have been studies done that show that blacks watch more television than any other racial group in the country, so that all the bad habits, we have them more than anybody else. So what that means is that things like literature and books, we tend to think of them in terms of television and visuals. We don't think of a book as being a very multifaceted type of experience. It has to have good and evil in it. So that when The Color Purple came out, and most of the people who really raised a lot of fuss about the book had not read the book. They had only seen the movie. They had only seen the movie. And the book and the movie are two entirely different experiences, because there's some things that happen in the book vis-a-vis those male-female relationships that are redemptive, that were not shown in the movie. But I think it just basically goes back to, because we are a powerless people, we are inordinately sensitive to and dependent upon the media for the image that we carry around of ourselves. And also because we do not get a chance to see a variety of images of ourselves. We don't see ourselves as, oh, a comedy about blacks, oh, a mystery about blacks. It tends to be the same images. It does bother us. Mm-hmm. It does bother us. But we tend to be inordinately dependent on that image from the media.
We only have a few seconds mm-hmm. left. So the last time we spoke, you were a journalist who had written a memoir and also had written a lot of poetry. And now now you're officially a novelist. Will you be writing more novels?
Oh, yeah. I'm knee-deep in my third one, my third book, my next book. And that's going to... I'll just say this is going to be a love story. One of the things I wanted to do in A Woman's Place was I wanted to write about love, because there hasn't been enough of that written by black writers. And so I did want to write a love story. So the next one will deal with that, too.
I wish you the best with it. And I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me back. Have me back for the next one.
Oh,
too.
I will. My guest has been Marita Golden. And her new novel, which is her first published novel, is called A Woman's Place. It's published by Doubleday. She's also the author of a memoir titled Migrations of the Heart, which will be coming out in paperback
next year.
So, like, after January?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, great. And the new novel, again, is called A Woman's Place. My guest's name, Marita Golden, and A Woman's Place is published by Doubleday. It's 3 minutes to five. All Things Considered is coming up in just 3 minutes. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
On the Schuylkill eastbound, there's a 25-minute delay between the Conshohocken curb and City westbound, 15 minutes between City and Belmont. Traveling 95 north, slow from Academy up to Woodhaven Road. Into New Jersey, kind of slow as you make your way across the Walt Whitman Bridge. 42 southbound is slow in the area of Route 295. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Cy Hannon's Deltona Discount Tire and Service Center. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by jazz trumpeter Art Farmer. Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be pianist George Shearing, so I hope you can be listening. That's about it for today's program. Paul Kerber and Ron Barron, the engineers on today's show, assistance from Marty Moss Cohen. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio.
Fresh Air was funded in part today by a grant from Eichler & Moffley Realtors with offices in Chestnut Hill, Bluebell, and Doylestown. Eichler & Moffley Realtors, bringing buyers and sellers together for more than 25 years.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman with All Things Considered.
We're telling the President of the United States, you can't think about it. You can't have a jelly bean. You shall deploy the members of the armed services.
In Congress on the House floor today, members approved the use of U.S. military force to stop drugs on their way into this country. That story tonight in All Things Considered.
Also, the stock market falling fast, perhaps a sign of concern about the U.S. economy.
In Chile, General Pinochet speaks to his nation, his 13th anniversary in power.
In Detroit, a television news producer in jail. He refused to surrender a videotape to a grand jury.
Also, Hard Choices reviewed. It's a movie about a teenager in Tennessee who is outside the law.
That and more coming up, but first this news.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The Dow Jones Industrial Average suffered its largest single-day decline today. The index plummeted over 86 points and closed at 1792.89. Analysts say a number of factors contributed to the fall, including a weakening of the bond market, indications that consumers would be spending less in the coming months, and continued concern over the size of the federal deficit. Wall Street set another record today for volume. Over 225 million shares were traded. The average price of a share lost $1.76. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres met today in Alexandria for the first summit between the two countries in 5 years. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
In an informal talk with reporters tonight, Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak said the discussions are concentrating on the Palestinian issue. Mubarak said the two leaders were also trying to find a way to move the Middle East peace process forward. Asked if Egypt would return an ambassador to Israel, Mubarak said, no problem. The two leaders spent 45 minutes together alone today. The Israeli Prime Minister also met with the Egyptian Prime Minister, Ali Lutfi. For National Public Radio, this is Deborah Amos in Alexandria.
Debate began in the Senate today on the nomination of William Rehnquist to be the nation's next Chief Justice. And as they did in his confirmation hearings, Democrats and Republicans disagreed over his qualifications. Senator Edward Kennedy said Rehnquist, quote, lacks the special qualities we expect of our nation's chief judicial officer. But Senate Majority Leader Robert Doyle said that resistance to Rehnquist was merely the defacing of a brilliant jurist with, quote, spray paint graffiti. Debate is expected to last several days before a vote. The Soviet Union said today a resolution in the case of jailed American reporter Nicholas Daniloff is possible and that it's up to the U.S. to make the next move. The comments came in a news conference held by Deputy Foreign Minister Vladimir Petrovsky. The BBC's Diana Goodman reports.
The low-key responses given by Mr. Petrovsky were in marked contrast to the colorful descriptions of Mr. Daniloff's alleged spying activities, which have been the official line since he was arrested. The minister did claim that the Americans knew quite well that the case against Nicholas Daniloff was legitimate, but he added that such incidents should not become an obstacle to the development of relations between the two countries, and the Soviet Union was doing all it could to stop that happening. Mr. Petrovsky said everything now depended on the American side. Asked about the case of Gennady Zakharov being held in New York, Mr. Petrovsky said he wanted to stress that the two cases were not related. However, he then appeared to link them by saying that the Soviet Union considered that a settlement of these cases was possible, increasing speculation that both men may be released on bail.
The BBC's Diana Goodman in Moscow. In Washington, Secretary of State George Shultz met for the second day with Soviet ambassador to the U.S. while the administration clamped the lid on any more comments regarding the case. The House of Representatives is debating a three-year anti-drug bill, with approval of the measure expected later today. A number of amendments have been passed, including a provision to deploy the armed forces to intercept drugs and arrest smugglers at U.S. borders. Meanwhile, President Reagan spoke to a group of business leaders about the drug problem and met with cabinet members to receive recommendations for steps to curb drug trafficking and consumption. CBS News President Van Gordon Sauter resigned today. The resignation comes on the heels of yesterday's shakeup at CBS. John Kalish reports from New York.
Sauter bid farewell to the network's executive producers this afternoon at CBS headquarters in Manhattan. He called CBS a glorious place to work for the last 18 years, but he said the difficulties of the past 10 months created an irreversible endgame. The news division has experienced morale problems, layoffs, and the cancellation of the morning news over the last year. Some CBS correspondents and commentators have spoken out on what they view as a shift in the news division's orientation toward entertainment. One network news writer said the resignation hasn't really sunk in at the news division. We'll see who replaces him, he said. A possible successor for Sauter is Bud Benjamin, who served as executive producer of the CBS Evening News in the 1960s and 1970s during the Walter Cronkite years. For National Public Radio, this is John Kalish in New York.
The government of Poland says it will release all political prisoners by Monday. According to the official Polish news agency, the plan does not cover people convicted of terrorism, espionage, sabotage, or betrayal of state secrets. In July, the Roman Catholic Church estimated there were about 350 political prisoners in Poland. The government said it held 189 and says 115 have been freed since then. And police in Pakistan say they've arrested an Arabic-speaking man on suspicion of helping with the hijacking of a Pan Am jet last week. I'm Lori Waffenschmidt.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Wendy Kaufman.
And this is Noah Adams. On Wall Street today, the stock market recorded its largest single-day decline in history. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 86 points, closing at 1,792, with 238 million shares traded. That is also a single-day record for the market. Hobart Rowan, Washington Post economics editor, says the decline is significant but not a record loss of value for the stock market.
During the great crash in 1929, on October 28th, the market was off about 12.5%, or 38 points. Because the overall index is higher these days, the bigger number means a lesser percentage. So today, it looks to be something like a 4% drop. That's a big drop, but not a record.
A lot of theories are about today to explain this drop.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said that Stan Weinstein, who writes a newsletter based in Hollywood, Florida, said that a bear market already has begun on the American Stock Exchange and that some trading was prompted by these remarks. What do you think about somebody like that?
Well, I sort of doubt that a move of this kind was prompted by any single individual. A lot of things were working here today. First of all, the economy has been weak and the market has been down for some months. Secondly, the West German government decided today not to lower interest rates. It had been hoped for, although it wasn't sure, that they would do that, which would help assure a further decline in interest rates here. On top of that, the economy has got all of these other weak factors that we've known of for some time. We have a huge trade deficit. The tax reform legislation causes uncertainties. The budget deficit is still there. And, of course, we have the debt crisis. And on top of that, as I read the news reports, we've had this basket or program trading, which enables institutional investors to take advantage of any disparity between futures contracts and the actual stock market prices.
Better explain the basket trading. And why would that be happening today?
With the aid of computers that can track the precise prices down to the last fraction of a penny, if you have lots of money, and what we're talking about here is baskets made up of $5, $10, $15, $25 million worth of stocks, if you can sell an index containing those stocks for one price and buy the actual stocks for another, it really doesn't matter whether one goes up and the other goes down as long as you have a cross profit. And apparently a lot of this was triggered this morning by the initial decline in stocks. There was a lot of institutional selling this morning, which made it profitable for people who had planned this way to assure themselves of a profit.
And why would that happen on this Thursday in September?
Well, there you have a question that I really can't answer, and I doubt that anybody really knows. One only begins to understand a market like today sometime after it's happened and after all the pieces can be analyzed and put together. I suggest that it probably was a convergence of things. The disappointment over the German action helped trigger it. I think there is continuing concern that there's nothing ahead to lift the economy up, and people do talk about a recession toward the end of the year or early next year. So there's a lot of concern. The market, even today, is well up over what it was at some points last year, and there are profits to be taken, and a lot of people took profits.
Hobart Rowan, economics editor for The Washington Post.
Today, the Senate began debate on the nomination of William Rehnquist to be Chief Justice of the United States. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The debate over the Rehnquist nomination is expected to last into next week. Today, his Democratic opponents laid out the case for voting no on the nomination. They charged that Rehnquist is an extremist in his legal views, that he didn't tell the truth in his confirmation hearings on a variety of subjects. They charged that he harassed minority voters when he was a lawyer in Phoenix and then lied about it before the Senate Judiciary Committee. They charged that his conduct was unethical when he participated as a Supreme Court justice in a Supreme Court case that he was involved in when he served in the Nixon administration. They charged that he was less than candid in his testimony about the restrictive covenants on his two homes. They charged that he was untruthful when he testified about a memo he wrote as a Supreme Court law clerk that supported school segregation. On and on went the allegations, but Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole rejected the charges as partisan phony baloney.
The case boils down to one simple fact. Those who would torpedo these nominations are liberal, and the president's nominees are conservative.